That was a portion of the title track from Conference of the Birds, Dave Holland's 1973 album with Anthony Braxton, Sam Rivers, and Barry Altschul. Dave Holland is my guest on this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. Hello, I'm Phil Freeman, and welcome to the Burning Ambulance podcast, part of the OSIRIS podcast network. If this is your first time listening, welcome, and if you're a longtime listener, welcome back. You can find us on iTunes, on Stitcher, and on a bunch of other podcast aggregators, or you can just visit burningambulance.com, where we have a lot of other content, including album reviews, interviews, videos, etc. If you are hearing us on iTunes, please consider giving us a star rating or even writing a review. And if you want to support us in a tangible way, that is to say by giving us money, go to patreon.com/burningambulance. The OSIRIS Network offers about 24 podcasts on all kinds of subjects, from music to craft brewing to journalism and literature to comedy to parenting. So visit osirispod.com and have a look around, because I'm pretty sure you can find at least a few other shows that will be of interest to you. They do live events from time to time, too, so if that's something you'd like to know more about, consider signing up for their email list. OSIRIS also partners with Relics, so visit relics.com for music news and whatnot. So Dave Holland is a jazz bassist who's played and recorded with a mind-boggling number of people over the last 50 years. He got his start in London in 1967-68, playing club gigs and stuff, and one night he was spotted by Miles Davis and invited to fly to New York on like 3 days' notice and join his band. He played on the Fiesta Kilimanjaro album, on In a Silent Way, on Bitches Brew, and ultimately he stayed with Miles until 1970, when he and Chick Corea both split off and formed Circle with Anthony Braxton and Barry Altschul. In the 70s, Holland worked with Braxton a lot. He worked with Sam Rivers a lot. He formed the trio Gateway with John Abercrombie, the guitarist who passed away last year, and Jack DeJohnette. And he's really never stopped working since 1968. He's led two different quintets under his own name, one in the 80s and one starting in the late 90s and continuing to the present day. That second quintet has also expanded at times to become an octet or a big band. Holland's newest album is called Uncharted Territory, and it's a double disc of extremely improvised music featuring Evan Parker on sax, Craig Taborn on keyboards, and Chez Smith on drums and percussion. It's extremely abstract music, and a lot of the time the group subdivides into duos or trios. There are only about 8 tracks out of 23 where the whole group is playing together. I'm going to play one of those quartet pieces now. It's a version of Q&A, which is actually another tune from Conference of the Birds, but this is obviously very different from the 1973 version. That's one of the things we discuss in this interview, along with his time with Miles Davis, the night he spent jamming with John McLaughlin and Jimi Hendrix, his time with Sam Rivers and Anthony Braxton, his work as a band leader, owning his own Dare 2 record label, and much, much more. We cover a lot of territory in this conversation, and I think you'll find it really fascinating. I know I had a really good time talking to him, so I hope you'll enjoy listening to it. So here's a little bit of Q&A from Uncharted Territory, and after that, you'll hear my interview with Dave Holland. Thank you.
I'd like to start with the new record.
Okay.
Your new album features Evan Parker and Chez Smith and Craig Taborn, and in a way it kind of closes a 50-year circle because the Spontaneous Music Ensemble Caryobin album also featured you and Evan Parker way back in 1968. So,
that's correct. In fact, that was just reissued. Evan did a wonderful remastering of it that's now been reissued. So,
oh, he did the remastering himself. Oh, okay.
He supervised it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. How many times have you and he linked up over the past 50 years? Often or rarely?
Well, I won't say it's frequently, but there's been times in terms of playing music together, we've done it. Not so much in the recent years. In the 80s and 90s, we did a few things together. An odd recording here and there. But we've remained good friends, and we frequently meet either usually in London. If I'm in London for any period of time, I always call him, and we have lunch together usually or something like that and catch up. So we've remained very, very good friends.
And you did a duo performance recently as a benefit also for the Vortex Club, right?
Yeah, we did. This was in March, and the Vortex is a club that provides a platform in London for a lot of really interesting music, and it's a non-profit organization, but it receives very little funding from any kind of institutions. In fact, almost none. And I've been going there. I went to see Evan play there with his group a few times, and we both decided we'd like to do a benefit to help the club. And what we did, we established a fund which allows us to curate some concerts there out of that fund. And we just did the first one, which featured two bands, one from the Royal Academy of Music, one from the Trinity College.
Mm-hmm.
Trinity Laban, and we have another one coming up in June, and then we're going to start a series in September of monthly concerts.
Oh, nice, nice. The new record is called Uncharted Territory, and I mean, I admit this is like a cheesy way of phrasing it, but you've played on literally hundreds of records in all kinds of contexts over the last 50 years, so is there really any territory that's new to you at this point?
Well, I hope there is every night or every time I play. I mean, that's the goal of improvising, is to explore new avenues, you know. The reason I guess I applied the title to this particular project is that for the large part it was something that was spontaneously improvised in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
So none of us really knew where we were going when we would begin recording. We just started and then let the piece evolve based on our instincts and what we heard from each other and the dialogue that was created and the sense of form that we all bring to the improvising context. And the three musicians that I was lucky enough to have with me on this recording are just masters of doing that. Chez and Craig and Evan, they've all created a very unique voice for themselves in the music, and are very comfortable in the open improvising context.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The record has there's a new version of Q&A on it from Conference of the Birds, and when I listened to both of them back to back, it kind of made me want to ask you about composition, because I mean, all they have in common is sort of like a little horn melody. So how do you compose generally? Do you compose on the bass or on some other instrument? And how much latitude do you give everybody else in the band when you're presenting a piece?
Well, I always like to say I compose by any means necessary. You know, it depends on, you know, how you approach it. Obviously, with complex pieces, more harmony, a more harmonic context, if I'm writing for a large group and so on, I use a keyboard. Mm-hmm. I find that's useful. Sometimes in the process of practicing, I'll be improvising and come across an idea that I feel could perhaps be used for a composition. That certainly happens. But I would say the main thing is that, you know, my writing has always been geared to who I'm writing for. It's usually for particular people, and it's very utilitarian in a sense that it's the idea is to present a context from which we can then start exploring development of that context. And that very much depends on what we're doing, what kind of approach we're taking in the music. And the other thing for me is also, as an improviser myself, the compositions feed my improvisational development, you know, so I write pieces which I find will challenge and help me develop ideas, things that I'm working on as a player. Mm-hmm. So there's a kind of symbiotic relationship. This is something that's, you know, been done by many players. I mean, I can cite quite a few, particularly John Coltrane. You know, he wrote a lot of songs like Giant Steps and things that came out of his studies and work process that he was using as a player. And then he would write a composition that would act as a vehicle for developing those ideas. So, you know, that's pretty much how I see composition when I'm working.
Yeah. It's always
The piece Q&A, I just thought it would be interesting to have these as bookends. You know, the piece was written actually originally for when I was with a band called Circle, which was involved Chick Corea, Anthony Braxton, and Barry Altschul. And that was a piece, that was a group that, yeah, it's probably 45 years ago, more actually, 48 years ago. We were also exploring a lot of different ways of dealing with improvisation and open improvisational context. So I thought it would be interesting to have that piece on this recording just as a kind of connecting point between those two projects, the earlier one and this one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think that your approach to composition, which is, you know, as you say, sort of utilitarian and then also kind of thinking of the group in a sense, do you think that you have that perspective because you are a rhythm section guy rather than a lead instrument guy? You know, I mean, you don't necessarily get that kind of generosity from trumpet players, for example.
Oh, I wouldn't like to categorize things like that. I mean, if you look at the work of Duke Ellington, he wrote for the players in his band.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
He thought of them. He thought of about where their strengths were as players. And I remember he said something about Cootie Williams. There was a certain 10-note range that he got a particular sound in, and he would write pieces that would help feature that. And of course, the beautiful ballads he wrote for Johnny Hodges and Harry Carney, the features he did for Harry Carney, all the players in his band, you know, were framed within a piece of music that allowed them to fly and allowed them to express themselves in their particular way, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now,
I wouldn't say that. Of course, I would think that as a certainly a bass player, rhythm section player, that has to have an impact on how I hear things and think of things as well. I mean, I do, for instance, I like music which has a strong interactive aspect to it between the rhythm section and the horns, you know. I always see that as a dialogue. And, you know, although maybe the horn's viewed as a soloist, it's also the great horn players work very closely with the rhythm sections. It's a conversation, a collaboration, you know, that's created.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, when you first started out, like the first records that I saw when I was looking up your discography was some records with Roy Budd, the piano player. But then at the same time,
I think that was the first recording I ever did, was a record called Live at Newport. It was actually Newport in Wales. They had a festival there, and it was a trio with a drummer, Chris Caron, who used to work with Dudley Moore's trio.
Oh, okay.
The actor and comedian, but also a fine piano player. And so Chris and Roy and myself, yeah, that was my first recording.
So, but at the same time, you were part of the Spontaneous Music Ensemble. So it seems like even at the beginning, you weren't drawing a line between free improvisation and more traditional jazz, which is kind of surprising because younger musicians I've found are frequently more militant about what they'll do and what they won't do. So Why do you think you had that openness even that early on?
I think I just love music of all kinds, you know, and that continues to today. I mean, right now I'm in New York finishing up a tour with Zakir Hussain, the master of the tabla, and you know, the stimulation and inspiration that and what I get to learn from playing with somebody like Zakir, who's just an amazing musician, and more than just what he plays, but how he interacts with you as a player, you know, it just feeds my creative process and my learning process as a player, which I'm, you know, trying to sustain even at this stage in my life. So it's and that is the governing principle that was there in the early days as well. I just wanted to know about music and enjoyed finding a way to interact with all kinds of different things. And when I discovered the sessions going on with the Spontaneous Music Ensemble at a club called the Little Theater Club, you know, I'd go there after I'd finished another gig and join in the sessions that were going on there. My activities in London were varied. It went from playing with Coleman Hawkins to playing with Evan Parker. Mm-hmm. And Chris McGregor's band, the South African band that came to London during the apartheid period. John Sermon, I was in a trio with John, and then of course working with some of the great English players like Tubby Hayes and Ronnie Scott. Yeah. So it was just as a young musician, I just wanted to learn. I wanted to learn from all these people, all these great players that I was around. And I never really thought about divisions in music. I never really thought about, you know, that one thing conflicted with another. I just saw it as a, you know, as a classical musician might one day play Mozart, another day play Bartok, another day play Xenakis, you know, it could, or Schoenberg. I mean, it's just a wonderful variety of music, which I've always celebrated. I don't feel that one thing contradicts the other. I just think it's all a big spectrum of expression. And then the same thing goes for cultural references, you know, like the flamenco project that I was involved with Pepe Habichuela, who's one of the great flamenco guitarists and part of an amazing family of flamenco artists. Mm-hmm. I've just did a record last year, a second record I've done with Anwar Brahim, the Tunisian oud player. And, you know, so all these things just help me look at music from different angles, really.
Yeah. Now, your first studio session with Miles Davis was in September of 68, and then immediately after that you were in the road band. And I'm curious, because he never played the music from the Kilimanjaro record live, but some of the tunes from Bitches Brew were in the live book, like, right away. So.
Yes.
Did he feel all along like Bitches Brew was gonna be a bigger album than Kilimanjaro, and that, you know, the label was behind it, so he had to sort of get behind it too? Or what was, do you know what
his
thought process was?
Well, I can't speak as to his thought process, honestly, but I think that, that's a good question. I've never really considered that. You know, we played the record after Fita Kilimanjaro was Silent Way,
mm-hmm.
and that material we did play.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It wasn't just the Bitches Brew material that we started playing on the road. I think maybe he, you know, I think the Fita Kilimanjaro album is a wonderfully constructed album with some fantastic compositions on it. Whether he felt that was something that he could explore further in the live setting, I don't know. We were still playing at that time the whole book of music from around midnight to So What to Nefertiti. You know, it was like a historical rendering of his music from, you know, early times. There's one gig, we never played Milestones, and then suddenly we were doing a gig at the Antibes Festival. And Miles had been playing Milestones with the previous quintet with Herbie and Ron and Tony and Wayne, and they'd done it very fast rather than the original sort of more medium tempo version. Well, we were on stage at Antibes, and in the middle of the set, Miles suddenly started Milestones at the medium tempo. And I remember Jack Dejanet, the drummer, and I looking at each other and kind of big smile on our faces that he suddenly decided to play it. It was a one-time thing. It's actually on a recording. It was released, you know, in the last few years, live in Antibes recording. And it was just out of the blue. So, I mean, why he chose the material he chose, I have no idea. I think he looked for things that had a long shelf life, you might say, things that allowed for a continued exploration of the ideas that the pieces represented.
Yeah, yeah. Did you ever...
Whether that's what influenced him not choosing the Fido Kilimanjaro material, I don't know. Half of that record, of course, or I think about half of it, was with the previous rhythm section with Ron and Herbie. And then Chick and I, there was a slight overlap. I played with Herbie for just the first 3 weeks of my being doing the gig. We had a gig at the Count Basie Club in Harlem, which was my first gig with the band in August of 1968. Mm-hmm. And then after that, Herbie got married. He went on a honeymoon, and when he came back, he decided he was going to start working on his own group, and so Chick stayed on in the band, and that became the new rhythm section, with Tony on the drums for probably about 8 or 9 months longer before Jack came in.
Yeah, yeah. There are, I've never heard them, but I've seen that there are bootleg recordings of you playing with Jimi Hendrix in the studio in 1969. Can you tell me about that, like how that came together?
Yeah, well, you know, this is a period when Jimmy was really exploring a lot of new ideas, trying things with different musicians, and he was at a stage where he was starting to sort of move into another direction. He wanted to take a group of people on the road, you know, have a tour bus and travel around America and just playing, you know, just, I think he was looking, you know, for the next stage of his music, where it would be going. And he, you know, he admired Miles's work, and as I understand it, they'd had some conversations about collaborating on some things. And so one day I got a call to go down to Electric Ladyland Studio and record and go there for the evening. And John McLaughlin was there, and Buddy Miles, and we just jammed. You know, there was no preset songs that we did. Jimmy would start a riff, and we'd jam on it for a while. And I think it was more like you know, a jam session for him, just a chance to play and maybe play with some new people. And that's what it amounted to. But of course, he was rolling tape at the time.
Yeah,
and it came out as a bootleg. I'm not sure how that happened. I mean, there was never an arrangement to release the recording. I don't think there was with him either. It came out posthumously after he passed, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Your relationships. You mentioned this a little earlier, and I wanted to talk about it a little more. Because in the early 70s, you were part of a small sort of group of players, like you, Sam Rivers, Chick Corea, and Anthony Braxton, you know, all working sort of together and separately and in various contexts. And it seemed like that was kind of a major development for you. So I'm curious what you think you learned from those guys when you were working together in, you know, 72 to 74 or whatever.
Yeah, well, you know, regarding Chick, we were in the Miles' group together, and we started working on some music in a trio format with Barry Altschul. And he and I at that time were both interested in exploring some other aspects of open form music, sometimes with thematic material being used as well, but that was one of the things we were looking at. And we played as a trio at the Village Vanguard, must have been late 69 or late 69, I think, or maybe early 70. And Anthony Braxton came down to hear us, and that's when I met Anthony. And the next day, we got together and had a little jam session during the day. And that's how Circle was born, the quartet with Barry and Anthony and Chick. And just prior to that, we'd done a recording called Song of Singing, which is a trio record that was done under Chick's contract with, I think it was Solid State Records, I believe. And so that was kind of a direction we were going in, and both Chick and I decided to leave Miles's group to follow that up. So that's what we did, and the group was formed, Circle, and then we went to Europe for a period of time, made some concerts there, one of which was recorded. It's the Circle Paris concert record. Mm-hmm. Then came back to America. We moved out to L.A., all of us, and we're struggling, to be honest. I mean, we were playing to very few people, but very committed to the music. And then at a certain point, Chick decided that he wanted to not be involved with that any longer, and he came back to New York, and that's around the time he started Return to Forever. Mm-hmm. So I got back to New York about 5 or 6 months later, and Barry had already come back to New York, and he'd started going to Sam Rivers' loft and just playing with him, I think, duo, and Barry suggested I come and join them. So we used to play at Sam's loft, for 3 or 4 hours at a time. And Anthony, in the meantime, had gone to Paris and stayed there for a while. And I had just begun a relationship with ECM Records while I'd been in Europe, with Circle, and that record came out on ECM. I did a duet bass album. Chick and Barry and I did a record called ARC that was, all these were on ECM Records. And they were early recordings that Manfred did. He just started the label Manfred Eicher. Mm-hmm. So I was playing with Sam. We started, at the time, my full-time gig was with Stan Getz. Oh. And I was working with Stan for a year and a half from, and then during that time I was with Stan, Manfred asked me if I wanted to do another recording, and that's how the Conference of the Birds record came together. And what I decided was that the people that I was feeling I was exploring the music that I was most interested in was with Sam and Barry in that trio. And I contacted Anthony, who was still in Paris, and I asked him if he'd come and join us and make it a quartet. And that's how the Comes of the Birds record came together. We did a couple of nights at Sam's loft studio, Rivby, which is the performance space that he supported, and then went in the studio and recorded.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the stimulation, your original question is, what did I get from those relationships? It was a chance to, fully vent my creative ideas, and within the freedom that I had in those groups. Very different situations. Sam was just open-ended. He just there was no written music. We just played and structured the music as we went, and it was like an open, a blank page of music every night. Whatever we wanted to fill it with, we could do. Anthony was much more of a structuralist in his composition. Anyway, I mean, not that Sam didn't compose. He wrote some amazing music. But in the small group, he liked to just go for it and just play, more open. And Anthony had these amazing structural ideas that he explores still to today, and presented some really challenging compositions to play. And he formed, during the 70s, a quartet, and included my good friend Kenny Wheeler on trumpet. And and Barry Elshall played drums with that group. So those were the sort of relationships that I was connected with. By that time, Chick and I no longer played together. He was going in a completely different direction. So our paths didn't converge again. But the two very strong connections I had with Sam and with Anthony continued. And then there was another band that started during that time that was called the Gateway Trio that...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That featured Jack Dejanet and the late John Abercrombie, and we had some amazing times with that group too.
Yeah, yeah. I was actually going to ask you about Gateway since John passed away like a little less than a year ago. And
yes,
I mean, you guys,
say, yeah.
You guys made three albums together in the 70s, two as a trio and then one with Colin Walcott on sitar, right?
Mm-hmm. And then we came back and did some more recording in the 80s too.
Yeah. So what was, on the first album, you wrote a lot of the music, the first Gateway album. So what was the concept of Gateway from your point of view?
Well, Jack initiated. Jack had been doing some things with John, and he and I wanted to continue doing some playing together after we'd worked with Miles. I mean, we had started our relationship in the mid 60s when he came to London and used to play together when he was there with for instance Charles Lloyd's band, and he came back again with the Bill Evans Trio with Eddie Gomez, and he spent several weeks there playing at Ronnie Scott Club, and we used to get together and play. So Jack and I had already formed quite a strong bond, which continues again to the present. And he thought this would be a nice context for us to play music in, and we hit it off right away. It had a freedom to it, but also could draw on a lot of different kind of musical directions, and we played a lot of different kinds of music. There was music. We all wrote for it. I don't know that the majority was the majority of the music on that first album. Mine, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think it was four.
I think John
out of six.
Contributed some, and Jack did as well. So
yeah, yeah.
But I mean, we did quite a lot of touring together. The albums, just represented some of the music we played. There was a lot of other music that we didn't actually record in the studio.
How would you describe your musical relationship with Jack Dejanet generally? Like, what does he give you as a drummer, and what does he want from you in return as a bassist?
Well, he's just my partner, my friend, my brother. You know, he's somebody that from the very first time we played together, which is a jam session, I was playing an after-hours jam session at a club in London. The club was closed, and Jack came in. I didn't know he was in the club, but I was on stage playing with a group of people, and suddenly I heard something happening over at the drums that was different. I looked over, and Jack had taken over at the drums. And from the minute we started playing together, it just felt perfect. You know, it's like putting on an old suit. You know, it just felt like fit perfectly. And we had discussions years later, year or two later. We were talking about records we used to practice with, and it turned out we used to often practice with the same records, you know.
Mm.
When we were learning about the music, and so I don't know, it's kind of hard to put my finger on what it is. We have a feeling for the time feel, I think, that's very compatible. We like to have fun with the beat, play around with it, turn it around, and be as a sort of playfulness sometimes to the playing, that's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's just a great guy, great good friend. I love him, and amazing musician.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the of Carlos Santana's whole sort of white suit period from about 1972 to 74, and one of the albums from that stretch is the Illuminations record with Alice Coltrane. What are your memories of that session?
Oh, Carlos is a really nice guy, just very open and loving, and he really wanted to bring together some new elements in the music, and he loved Miles's bands and loved the work that Jack and I had done with Miles, and I think he just wanted to be, you know, have a chance to interact with us musically, and it was a very very relaxed and very spontaneous kind of thing, really. I mean, we the music was put together in the studio as we went, and you know, it had a very spontaneous feel to it, is what I remember. And just a good vibe, you know. We enjoyed being together and hanging out, as well as making music. And I've seen him on and off on occasion in recent times. We did a concert actually at the Hollywood Bowl a couple of years ago that Herbie put together, and Carlos was there. And then when Herbie got the Kennedy the award that year, Carlos also got the award at the Kennedy Center. Mm-hmm. I was there to celebrate it as well.
Nice. You also recorded with Joe Henderson a couple of times in the 1970s, and then recorded with him again 20 years later. So what was different the second time? How had you changed? How had he changed? You know, what was the relationship like?
Well, I'd worked with Joe, first of all, very briefly in London at the Ronnie Scott Club. I'd already, a couple of weeks before the gig started, the situation with Miles hearing me at the Ronnie Scott Club and asking me to come to New York to play with his group happened, and I was waiting to get the final word on what was going to happen. And I started a gig with Joe when after the first night, I came home, and that evening, or rather in the early hours of the morning, I got a call from Miles' manager saying, can you be in New York in 3 days? And so I didn't get to finish the run with Joe there. But when I came to New York, yes, Joe did a couple of recordings that he asked me to be involved with. He was an amazing musician, an incredible saxophone player, and he wrote some music, certainly, that had a big impact on the musical community. The recordings he did in the 60s really set a new direction in those compositions. And myself and a lot of the young musicians in London, you know, listened very carefully to those recordings. So he made a real impact on people, and not just in England, of course, here too.
Yeah.
The interesting thing was, you know, all through his career, Joe had a book of music, a collection of songs that he liked to play. It was like his songbook, and that didn't change that much. He did other songs for records that he did, and you know, so the new material was played on the recordings. But the gigs that we played together very often featured more or less the same songs that he'd been playing for many years. And it was just like he'd been honing these songs and finding new ways to approach them. So that was interesting. And how did we change? Boy, I can't even think about how to answer that. I mean, you know, I guess as you develop your music, you start to find ways to be more succinct and you know, fine-tune your approach to the music and your vocabulary and so on. And the last gigs that I did with him were just wonderful. They were just in a trio context, which I love. I love that saxophone, bass, drum trio setting. And, you know, fortunately, several of them have appeared on YouTube and gigs we did. And so I get a chance to listen to them and relive them a little bit.
Yeah. You formed your first quintet in the 80s and made three albums for ECM with them. And I'm curious, like, you say you had a long relationship with Kenny Wheeler, and the combination of him and Steve Coleman is really an interesting one, and not one that would have jumped immediately to people's minds, maybe. So how did you, you know, come about combining those voices and putting that band together?
Well, just in a general way, you know, I like diversity in the band. I don't want everybody to be on playing the same way. You know, I refer to Duke Ellington's band. You know, each person had an individual sound and an approach to the music. And I think for me that makes the music broader and more interesting. And that band had another great horn player in it, Julian Priester, who also has his own voice and his own sound. So, you know, that three horn front line, first of all, I like this. It was a sound that I heard, you know. I kind of thought back to the New Orleans days, of course, with the trumpet, trombone, and clarinet often in the front line, but that was part of the sound, and then, you know, bass and drums added to that, and that kept the harmonic context really open. Kenny has been part of my life since I was in London. You refer to the early recordings I did. One of the records I did in the early days was the Windmill Tilter album. That's just a beautiful example of Kenny's writing, and that I had the opportunity to perform on. So Kenny's music has been a part of my life all the way through, and still is. I still play his music, and it represents a really unique body of work that he presented, and some amazing big band writing that he did. You know, I had, as I said, played with Anthony Braxton, who had also included Kenny in that group, and Kenny's music, it spans, you know, the whole range of playing, from really strong harmonic settings to free music and the things that he did with the Spontaneous Music Ensemble that we were talking about earlier. And that's something also that I like in my relationships with musicians, the musicians that have a broad range of musical approaches that are personal, but at the same time can handle all kinds of different settings, you know. So that group for me was what I was hearing for my first venture as a band leader. Mm-hmm. So the polarities were, as you say, you know, strong. I mean, I see the same thing with Conference of the Birds. You know, two saxophone players, really different, Sam Rivers and Anthony Braxton, really different in their approach, their sound, the feel that they play with, you know. But that diversity, I think, really added something to that recording.
And you wanted that sort of openness to give the horn players room to run, which is why there was no piano, right?
Yeah, I'd been working in a lot of pianoless groups and enjoyed, you know, from early days of listening to Ornette's group and the kind of freedom and mobility that had when it wasn't anchored by a chordal instrument. And so I wanted to have that in that early quintet.
Yeah. And the second quintet, I feel like, is interesting to me because you sort of had a bridge between them, which was Robin Eubanks, but because he came in at the end of the first one and then came back for the second one. But the second one I felt like was more, at least on record, was more focused on rhythm than the first. So, I mean, were you doing something differently with that band, like consciously, or...
Yeah, I think at that point that was something that I was working on. As I said, when we were discussing, you know, composition, one of the things that I wanted to develop in my own playing was, you know, working in different rhythmic contexts and different time signatures and a variety of time signatures, I should say. So that was part of what we were looking at, and again, it was to do with the players I was playing with, you know, thinking about what would be creating an interesting context for everybody to develop as a band. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it was largely coming from what I was looking at as a player and what I was trying to develop. There were certain harmonic approaches that I was working on as well. And it was partly to do with what I thought would really work with that group of people.
Yeah, Yeah.
You know, having the vibraphone there gave another percussive aspect to the music, and I think that encouraged a certain way of thinking about the compositions. And of course, Steve Nelson, who's an amazing musician, I can't say enough about him. You know, he brings an incredible harmonic vocabulary with him as well. And so that was another thing that I explored more in the writing I was doing for that group.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about the sort of, I guess the best way to put it would be like the generational aspect of it. Because, for example, I think Chris Potter comes up after the initial, you know, the wave of musicians that you came in with. So did you have that sort of, like, elder statesman leader thing going on in your head at all?
No, I didn't think about that at all. I was just thinking about who, you know, who I wanted to play with. Yeah.
So you don't worry about, you know, feeling responsible to, like, bring up younger players or anything like sort of an Art Blakey-ish type of a mindset at all?
It's not that I feel responsible. I mean, it's something that I'm an equal opportunity person, you know. I mean, I just want to find musicians I want to play with. And, you know, the band had some younger players like Billy Kilson and Chris. And then some players that are a little bit older like Robin and Steve and then myself. So it wasn't really a thing of saying, okay, I got to find young players. But on the other hand, when you say, do I feel responsible? I'm involved in quite a few educational situations, and that's where I see my responsibility is trying to, encourage creativity in young people and share what I can of my experiences with them.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a responsibility I feel, you know. But, you know, as I said, it's about the music and, yeah, I'm trying to listen to what's happening with the next generations as well. It's a two-way relationship when you play with another musician, and sometimes in playing with a younger musician who perhaps have come up through more, not perhaps, definitely have come up through a time when they've been listening to other music than you might have done when you were coming up as a young player. And some of that music sometimes turns out to be the music you've done yourself, you know, that I've recorded in the past. And that brings another perspective to me on what can be done. And so there's a real positive exchange, I think, cross-generational that happens in the music. And that's something I do enjoy. And again, it's something that I experience quite a bit with my teaching activities, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I spoke to Charlie Hayden some years ago about teaching, and because he was a professor at Cal Arts, I guess, for many years. And he was talking to me about the fact that he says, you know, I don't teach my students harmony. I don't teach them theory. You know, they get all that stuff in their other classes. He says, I teach them to look at the stars. And, you know, I try and encourage, sort of encouraging like an improvisatory mindset. So, I mean, is that what you focus on with younger students or?
I try to focus on whatever I feel is going to be useful to them. You know, every musician is different. And I think the goal of the teacher or coach is to help the player release their own creative ideas, and whatever can be done to help that happen. Sometimes they do need some help, and they might be curious about music, for instance, that I've written or that I played, or you know, and they may want to discuss that or the compositions and things like that. Well, I'll discuss it, of course. I mean. Or the rhythmic things that we were just discussing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, it's really, I feel that teaching needs to be done in relationship to who you're teaching, you know, and what stage they're at, what their level of understanding is, what they need. You know, I've been involved with a couple of organizations that are dealing with 12 to 18-year-olds. Well, that's a whole different set of things that you deal with them. As you might with somebody you know, in their 20s or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
they're at a different stage in their development, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The second quintet was also the core of the octet and the big band. So do you do the arrangements yourself for the larger ensembles? Because we were talking about that a little bit earlier. And
yes, I do. Yeah.
Yeah. And who's, you know, like, who's your model as an arranger? Like, what are you attracted to in the big band format? I know we were talking about Ellington to a degree. So
Billy Strayhorn was one of the people that I love his arranging style. Kenny Wheeler, Duke Ellington, Thad Jones, you know. I don't want to compare myself with those people, but they're people that have given me inspiration and who've, you know, I've listened to how they approach using the band in different ways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, this is sort of a goofy question, but it is something that I noticed. As soon as you left ECM and formed Dare 2, your album covers started to feature a lot of really bright colors. So how big a factor was that in your decision?
No, that wasn't why I started my own record label. It was, I mean, that was what I wanted to have on the covers of my albums for the new label, yeah. But it wasn't an issue that I needed to start a label so I could have different album covers. it was just to have some more independence about when I record, when I release records. I had already been producing my own recordings prior to leaving ECM. So for the last 7 or 8 years, I think I'd been going in the studio and doing the production myself, and then offering it to Manfred Eicher at ECM as an idea for a recording, and he would then put it out. But I wanted to have, you know, as I said, a little bit more control over some aspects of the way promotion is done, and this is not against ECM. It was not in opposition to it at all. It was merely another step in becoming an independent musician and all the things that allows. One of which is ownership of the masters.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, as a business decision, generally, how has it, do you think it's worked out well for you? I mean, you know, is
in what respect?
In the sense of, because the industry obviously is changing a lot, you know, seemingly day by day in terms of revenue and in terms of distribution and all these sorts of things. So is it, you know, have you been able to make it work and make it sustainable and everything?
Yeah, we're still going.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I mean, the albums have been out there and reaching people, and I'm very happy with how it's been, you know. You mentioned promotion and the changing climate of the record business. Well, that was another thing that I had some thoughts about and wanted to do and take advantage of. And you know, there's a lot of things opened up that independent musicians can take advantage of now. Ways of distributing and connecting up with your audience, you know. The advent of the internet changed a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, some as we know, have had some negative impact on record sales, but it's had a positive impact on the ability for the audience to access the music.
Yeah, yeah, that was
and
actually...
that's what I like about it. I like the fact that, you know, that somebody who wants to find an album that might not have been in a record store 20 years ago can find it instantly on the internet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was something I was curious about, because I know your releases are available on streaming services like Spotify and stuff like that. So you see that as a net positive, do you think?
I think it would be nice that musicians could get a better revenue stream from those things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that you know, it's still important for us to make some money on recordings because we need to finance new recordings.
Yeah.
And if the records are only being listened to online, and you know, the revenue that comes from the royalties that that you get from Spotify and other sources are very minimal compared to what you would get for a record sale. So on the other hand, if you're putting out your own records, the profit margin is better than you would have if you were just going for artist royalties.
Yeah.
You know, so you know, that there's some offsetting there. And I have to say that fortunately the listening audience that we have still likes to have many of them like to have copies of the recording on their shelf. You know, like to have the CD or vinyl. We've been putting out vinyl copies as well.
Yeah. Your 2016 album Aziza, is that a band that's going to continue? Tell me a little bit about.
We're about to go to St. Lucia next week to play a festival there, and then we've got a big tour in the fall.
Okay.
It's actually a project that I view as a kind of co-led project because we're all writing music for it, and it came together in that way. You know, it was actually Chris and I had been talking about doing a project or getting involved in a new project, and and Eric had been a choice for both of us as far as drummer, and we were thinking, you know, around, you know, what else, and we both had enjoyed working with Lionel, and Chris said, what about if we asked Lionel if he'd like to be involved, and sure enough he did want to get involved, and that's how the band came together.
Yeah. So you are planning on, you know, possibly a second record, or, you know, just...
We haven't discussed that yet, but I don't want to jump the gun on that, but we're still playing together. We just did a concert a month or so ago as part of a series that I did for the San Francisco Jazz Center. They host these residences, 4-day residences, and I did a 4-day residency, and so one of the projects was Aziza. So we find opportunities to get together. Each of us has other things going on, you know, our own projects, our own groups, and we also play with other people, so it's not going to be a band that works 12 months of the year, but we love playing together. We have a lot of fun when we do, and we wanted to do another big tour this fall, and we'll see what comes out of that.
Yeah. I guess my last question is, you've got a new record out, or new-ish record, with Anwar Brahim, you mentioned earlier, and as we're talking, you're on the road finishing up this tour with Cross Currents, which is the new band with Zakir Hussain. And so I'm curious what draws you to, or what you get from non-Western musical traditions, and what you respond to from that in your own work. You know, how that stuff inspires you.
And by the way, this summer we're touring in a trio context. We call the Cross Currents Trio, and that's with Zakir, Chris, and myself. We've been doing a feature in the concerts of the trio when we've been doing this tour and previous tours as well. This is, I think, the third tour we've done with the band. And so we decided to do a summer tour this year with three of us. So that's coming up.
Oh, cool.
So just to get to your question, I guess I can refer to my earlier answer, you know, which is just music. You know, it's all music. And what I get from one music, it's not so much what I get, it's the interaction of playing with a musician and what they bring to the table. And, you know, it's a kind of, when you play with another musician, you're reaching a commonality between you. And whether it's music from another culture, in the case of the flamenco project I did with Pepe Habichuela, or the thing with Zakir, or playing with Anwar, it's just the polarities that you you know, that come together in a music and what that draws from you. And this happens also between musicians that work in the same genre, you know, jazz musicians. I play with one musician, and you find different commonalities than you might with another. It's just the way music is made. It's how you play together. It's how you come to agreements about what it is that you're doing, what the music's going to be about, and what each of you bring to the table.
Mm-hmm.
And then you find some common ground to work with each other. That's what's inspiring to me. Now, in the case of Anwar, it's not just the the sound of the music. There's something about his music which has a very, very profound, peaceful, deeply, you know, I'm hesitant to use the word spiritual, but it has. When we were performing, we just finished this tour together with Jack DeJohnette and Django Bates, a very fine English pianist. It brought a sense of peace to the audience that I really found very satisfying. It very special, enticing kind of music, and so it wasn't just the language, the scales, the rhythms, and things that we were using, but it was also the sort of profound mood of the music that embraced everybody, and that was one of the things that was special with that.
Okay, that was my interview with Dave Holland, and that's the end of this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast, which is part of the OSIRIS network. Visit osirispod.com to check out more of our podcasts, and visit relics.com for music news. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I hope you'll come back for the next one. OSIRIS.